Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Om Shri Sai Ram. Sai Ram and respectful greetings to all our listeners from Team Radio Sai. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday Live coming to you from Prashanti Nilayam, the spiritual capital of the universe. Today is the 31st of January 2013. My name is Karuna and I will be your host for this segment called Morning Glory. And yes, with Swami's grace, I do hope to bring you an inspiring lineup of programs this morning. By the way, managing the control panel here is audio engineer Yatharta with me. The time in Prashanti Nilayam right now is 9:37 a.m. The Vedam and the Bhajans have just concluded in the Mandir. The Sai Gayatri is still going on as devotees are proceeding to the Holy Mahasamadhi to offer their homage. At this abode of supreme peace, every single day is new and special. Who won't vouch for this statement as we continue to feel the live and real connection between Swami and us? Isn't it uncanny how easily the Lord of Prashanti has become the Lord of our hearts, guiding, prompting and assuring us from within of His omnipresence in our lives? At Radio Sai, we bow to His glory and His splendor with love and humility. We belong to Bhagwan entirely, conclusively and wholly, and we pray that He may always find us worthy of being His instruments. Here now is the weather report from the Divine Valley. At Prashanti, we continue to enjoy great climatic conditions, although the afternoon sun tends to warm up just a tiny bit with maximum temperatures in the early 30s and lows of about 18 degrees Celsius. And now for some headline news. On January 24, 2013, the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust commenced the extension work for the Anantapur Water Project. You may recall that in 1995-96, Bhagwan had undertaken the largest ever water project by an NGO. With this, he had brought clean drinking water to most parts of the Anantapur district of Andhra Pradesh, which is traditionally drought-prone. He later extended the scheme to two other districts of Andhra Pradesh, namely Medak and Mehboobnagar. And then, Bhagwan also executed a humongous water project for the city of Chennai in neighboring Tamil Nadu. Now, the recently proposed extension of the Anantapur Water Project will involve laying another 80 kilometers of new pipeline to bring clean, fluoride-free water to another 2.5 lakh, which is 250,000 people, in 118 villages. And the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust will spend 80 crore rupees on this project. Just like the Sri Satya Sai clean water, we pray that Swami's unconditional love, grace and blessings continue to flow freely upon you today. And now, for today's episode of Morning Glory, I have two exciting programs lined up for you. A fortnight ago, that is on January the 16th, 2013, we woke up to a pleasant surprise. And it was in the form of a blog in the Huffington Post, which was titled Revisiting Puttaparthi and the Abode of Peace. It was posted by one Dr. Vamsi Juluri, a name we did not quite recognize at the outset. The byline described Dr. Juluri as a novelist, author and professor of media studies at the University of San Francisco in the United States. Within minutes, we tracked Vamsi Juluri, who has received his PhD in communication from the University of Massachusetts in the U.S. in 1999, We further learned that his research interest is in the globalization of media audiences with an emphasis on Indian television, especially on the influence of MTV in this country, naturally an area of keen interest for us at Radio Sai. After a quick exchange of emails, we caught up with Dr. Vamsi Juluri over the phone and I will play that interview for you shortly. And later on the show, I will bring you an episode of Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories that is yet to be aired on Asia Stream. It is an insightful and thought-provoking conversation with a former bandleader and alumnus of the Satya Sai University, and his name is Mr. S. Sriram. But first, let's talk about Dr. Juluri's post in the Huff Post about his recent visit to Puttaparthi. Let me quote a few lines here and there from this piece that he wrote, Visiting Puttaparthi and the Abode of Peace. And I quote him, he says, "On a bright sunny January morning, as people in India celebrated the festival of Sankranti, I returned to Prashanthi Nilayam. Sitting once again in the vast expansive halls of Prashanthi Nilayam, I felt strangely empty of expectation. The protocols though, and of course the people, were very much the same as before. There were lots of people as always, and they sat in more rows than one could hope to count without getting up. Short programs featuring students from Baba's schools and colleges were conducted, the ever-popular bhajans were sung, and the sacred aarti offered. At the end, though, everyone lined up for what is now called Samadhi Darshan. Nothing has changed in Prashanthi Nilayam. The ceremonies, the celebrations, the students' earnest and enchanting plays and performances, the bhajans that made this movement so simple and easy to belong to, and most of all, the people, the vast and reasonably well self-regulated throngs of devotees, seekers and the curious who came, they were all there. And yet, everything has changed too. How could it not? Like Shirdi, Puttaparthi will remain a place where faith lives and resonates for the faithful. But there is also the other miracle that took place in this speck of a hamlet in a dry and desolate corner of South India no one would have heard of but for one simple peasant son. That miracle, I think, is still unfolding. We may see its visible manifestations in the form of gigantic hospitals that offer free treatment to all and water pipes and tankers that quench the thirst of thousands of villagers in India's most arid regions. But there is more to come too." Unquote. Dear listeners, thanks to some quick thinking and technical wizardry, we caught up with Dr. Vamsi Jaluri over the phone from Hyderabad just before he left India for San Francisco. I hope you will enjoy this interview with someone who turned out to be a member of our very own Sai family. Listening to him, you're likely to place him very quickly. Here is the telephone conversation with Dr. Vamsi Jaluri from last week. Sir, I'm Dr. Vamsi Jaluri. Thank you for joining us for this telephone interview from Hyderabad. We just read your piece in the Huffington Post after your Sankranti 2013 visit to Prashanthi Nilayam, and it definitely made for an interesting and inspiring read. And it was hard to miss the voice of the devotee in there. So would you please tell our listeners about your journey to Swami, how and when it began?
Jai Sairam. My own story, the mundane story, begins in the 1970s and 80s, mm-hmm. when I was a teenager.
And where did you live then, in Hyderabad?
Yes, I was born and I grew up in Hyderabad, mm-hmm. studied in the Hyderabad Public School, mm-hmm. an institution for which Swami always had a lot of affectionate, you know, jokes and comments about.
Why do you say that?
I don't know, there were a few Sai brothers I know who also studied in my school.
Okay.
And, you know, in some ways I think the culture of my school was not quite the kind of trajectory which brought me to Swami. Mm-hmm. But somehow that mixture of, you know, studying in HPS and then coming to Swami, I find a very special bond that exists with, you know,
I
children
see.
From my school who come to Swami. So I studied in school, and when I was very young, about 7 years old, it was perhaps in 1976, my parents were invited to call on Swami and take his blessings at Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my parents were not yet devotees.
Which is the Sai Center in Hyderabad, the main Sai hub, Shivam.
Yes, the main Sai Center in Hyderabad. My father is Professor Ramana Rao. He used to teach at Usmania University. He taught wildlife zoology.
Mm-hmm.
And later he was also associated with Swami's educational institutions, and I'll come to that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother is Srimati Jamuna, the movie actress who has acted in many, many movies, and she was very well known in India in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And later she was also a member of parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think my journey to Swami also has a lot to do with my parents and who they are and how the three of them just did magic on me in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you that story more as well. So in 76, my parents, you know, very devout, they were devotees of Raghavendra Swami and Venkateswara Swami, a fairly orthodox South Indian culture. They had spiritual culture. We went to see Swami, and I was very young, and I vaguely remember a lot of people there and some singing. And after that, we had a small private darshan with Swami. And I remember him being just very kind and also giving us some vibhuti. After that, for many, many years, there was no mention at all. You know, it was as if he had just met a holy person and, mm-hmm. you know, we took blessings. And it just felt like that's all there was to it.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when we came back to Swami, we understood, I think, that maybe in his own way, telling us, you're going to come to me and I'm going to take care of you sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
So this was in 76. And then the following years, as I was going through school, as I was came into middle school and high school, we kept encountering some very nice, you know, people who were all very good devotees of Swami.
Mm-hmm.
And that one mark we always saw, whoever was a devotee of Swami had a very distinct culture and personality. And even as a child, I could see that. You know, they were very, very courteous and kind. And there was a signature about their conduct, which was very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I should mention one more person who, in a strange way, I think also marked the seeds of my journey to Swami, and that is Professor B.V. Pattabhiram. Listeners from Andhra Pradesh might know me. He's a very famous
yes.
magician and a public speaker and an ardent devotee of Swami.
Yes.
So Professor Pattabhiram was my magic guru briefly when I was about 12 or 13 years old. And I wanted to be a magician, and so he taught me magic. And of course, the real magic was unfolding without my realizing it, which was the fact that Pattabhiram Garu was a devotee of Swami. And I mean, I obviously could see again that there was something very special about Swami, which you would not know from, you know, the public talk and the media and all that. You know, I could discern that. And then there was an aunt and uncle in California with whom we stayed on a vacation, and they were very ardent devotees of Swami. They told us wonderful stories. So I think in all these ways, you know, there were these amazing experiences we were encountering. But the real dense journey began in the mid-1980s
mm-hmm.
when my father was invited
mm-hmm.
by one of his university colleagues to participate in the setting up of the university.
I see.
And I still remember vaguely, you know, I was in the 8th, 9th class around that time. And my father, you know, would take off. He'd go to a lot of universities on university work, and he would say, I'm now going to Puttaparthi. And he would go and come, and, you know, the first time he went to him, he said, it's a really amazing place. You know, it's just very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And because until then, you know, none of us could even imagine that what was happening in Puttaparthi, what an amazing journey that Swami was taking everybody on in, you know, in terms of education mm-hmm. and even in practical terms. So my father would keep coming back from Puttaparthi with amazing stories about the place, about the university mm-hmm. and the students and the staff there, and really about Swami's educational mission. And I still recall, you know, initially he wouldn't say much about Swami. You know, he would just say the place is very good, it's yes. very professional, it's got very high standards.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when, probably in 1985, 86, one day he just kind of, you know, tells me in a very brief but confident father-to-son mode, something like, this is real, you know, this is the real thing. And he met Swami. Soon after that, my mother went along with him to see Swami.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother has an amazing story too, and I'll very briefly, she was in politics at the time,
mm-hmm.
and she was, you know, kind of disheartened and thinking of quitting, and then she addressing a huge public meeting very close to Puttaparthi. And apparently she just felt like praying to Swami that day and said, Swami, please guide me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she went to see Swami, this was in September 1986,
mm-hmm.
They were just overwhelmed, you know, and he just showed us what his love is about. How do you mean?
Did he call you for an interview?
This was my mother and father were called for an interview in September. And then they came back, and I could just see something had happened to both of them, especially to my mother, you know, the sheer faith with which they came back at Swami. Even though I had not yet really encountered him, I could just see that there was something very, very significant about his presence. And my journey, which I remember very, very vividly, so the day my sojourn, or my, not my sojourn, my return to Swami's feet began was December 31st, 1986.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there for the first time with my mother and father and sister, a lot of family members. And that's the day I first saw Swami. He spoke to me, gave us an interview, and everything began for me that day.
Wow. So what after that important day in your life, December the 31st, 1986, what was the impact of the Sai connection? Did he advise you on your life, and did he impact the direction it took?
Absolutely, in more ways than one. So I still remember the first words, you know, Swami, we were sitting on the sand that morning. It was a sunny December morning, and those days there was still sand outside
mm-hmm.
the mandir.
That's right.
And So it was an amazing feeling, and it was like being in a very holy place, like going to Tirupati up the hill or something. It had that feeling. And Swami was walking in from my right, and he called my name. And then I got up a little bit, and then he gave me some vibhuti, and then he called me and my parents inside. And we had an interview, and that was my first interview with
Swami.
How
old were you then, Vamsi?
Very important fact. I was 17 years old,
okay,
in class 12.
Oh, I see. And so, he just called you Vamsi. He just called out your name.
Yeah, he said he walked up saying, Vamsi Krishna, Evaru, you know. And
who is Vamsi Krishna?
Yeah, so which was also a profound question. Now I kind of think that I was meant to ponder that question, you know. So it was very playful, and there was just something so special, you know. I mean, I was revering him, but at the same time there was a feeling like he was also a friend, you know, maybe like a senior from school. I know it sounds strange to say it. So he felt less, partly like a parent, partly like a, you know, like a much older and wiser brother. So there were just so many levels. And of course, I don't know how to articulate it, but somehow from that moment, he has been God. So before that moment, you know, God was more abstract. He was Krishna and Rama and all these things. Mm-hmm.
So what exactly did he tell you behind the doors in the interview room?
He asked me what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had told me, kind of prepped me for that. She said, you know, when Swami says, what do you want,
mm-hmm,
you know, don't say ring or chain. Just say, Manchi Chaduvi Vandi Swami.
Means I want to study well?
Yeah, I want to study well. So I wanted to say it in English, and I didn't know how to say it. So I said, Swami, I want knowledge. And which actually produced a couple of chuckles in the room, you know, from some brothers and sisters, because I know it was maybe a little too earnest. But he took it at face value. You know, Swami did not, he took it very seriously, you know, and he kind of paused for a moment, and then he said, knowledge is there, you're just not using it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and now in retrospect, I believe that, you know, that request to Swami, because we believe that every word we say, everything we do, once we get our egos and fears and things like that in check, is pure God in action. It's pure Swami's will in action, because, mm-hmm, you know, that's how I understand Swami and us now, you know. So Swami made sure, you know, that, you know, God is ours, but he told me the right thing to ask, like knowledge and not 6 months of sleep, like Kumbhakarna, I guess. So, and so once I said that, so he said, you have the knowledge, it's there. And now I really feel that, in a way, that's what has been my journey. It's been about understanding the world through my teaching, through my writing, and just through my, you know, family life and so on. And once he said that, he called me closer, he beckoned me closer, so I leaned forward towards him. And he waved his hand downwards, as many of us have had the great fortune of, you know, seeing him do. And suddenly there was, something metallic and golden and heavy just flashing and wriggling. And he gave me a watch, which I wear to this day. And then he said, what is this? And I said, Swami, this is a watch. And he said, what is the spelling? And then he began my education, and he told me, as I spelled watch, he said, W, watch your words, watch your actions, watch your thought, watch your character, and watch your heart. And, you know, I take that as a gift, both the sacred gift he gave me for me to keep on my body, and also the lesson. And of course, so that is the first lesson I received from Swami, and then over the years it has grown. Now, the interesting thing since about that particular, how all this happened, the fact that I was in 12th class, I think, mm-hmm, is very relevant to the whole, my whole journey with Swami,
mm-hmm,
to and with Swami. Because in what happened in the next year or two was very, very interesting, because I was finishing my 12th class,
mm-hmm,
and getting ready to write my engineering entrance exams, because as we know, somehow in India, it's the unspoken rule that almost all of us study engineering or medicine.
That's right.
And
that's coming from Andhra Pradesh, computer engineering.
yes, absolutely. You know, when you are at that age, you know, and if any of our listeners right now are at that age, you know, of 16, 17, 18, you're wondering what to do after school, you know, it is a very, very significant time. And the best thing you can do is, regardless of what you specifically do, if you know Swami, if you believe in Swami, if Swami is gracious, come looking for you, accept it, you know, draw it in. Because somehow or the other, Swami will make it work out for you. You know, you will find the way to find a journey that is meaningful to you, that is rewarding for you, and ultimately fits in, and or rather, it will give you the space to fit in with Swami's plan to make this a better world.
And how did you find yours?
So Swami, you know, asked me and my parents what I wanted to do, and, you know, since everybody said engineering, I said engineering. So he kind of encouraged me, and, you know, he really encouraged me to study engineering. And now here's the strange thing that happened. That whole episode turned out to be a failure. I was unable to complete my engineering. I quit in just 2 years, and which was a very, you know, intriguing, you know, journey for me, because on the one hand, I did it. I mean, I said I can do it, even though I knew I was doing very badly in math, and, you know, I should have seen the reality and perhaps done something else. But for whatever reason, a mixture of illusion or false hope or bravado, I don't know why, but I chose to do engineering and then I failed. And it was a very strange and mixed up time for me, because I went through a very, you know, hard time, you know, dealing with failure and dropping out and all these things. My parents were very worried about me. This was now 1989, 1990, but, and my father had just retired, and you know, my mother was very busy with politics, and so it was a very, you know, confusing time for me, you know, figuring out what I wanted to do. And now in retrospect, I realized that, you know, Swami just kind of gave me the space to find myself, but also gave me the wisdom and his grace and protection to make sure that I came back to him.
And you didn't fall through the cracks, because you were very vulnerable.
I tried my best to go through the cracks in many ways. But, I mean, just being, you know, occasionally filled with despair and writing very dark poetry and, you know, wondering about the meaning of life, all those things. But somehow, you know, Swami, there was like Swami's voice and presence in our lives was like a thread. It was like somehow he was going to pull me back. I just had that faith that somehow I would find my, you know, way back again.
Did you used to pray? How did you feel the connection? Did you pray to him? Did you come to Puttaparthi? Was it just internal, unsolicited?
So interesting. It started, you know, those 2 years I was in engineering, because I was studying in Bangalore, and, you know, I was, you know, very much in the care of Swami devotees and families in many ways at that period. I used to come to Puttaparthi fairly often in those 2 years, and, you know, Swami, you know, gave me and my parents numerous interviews at the time, and, you know, inquired about my well-being. And so for about 2 years, I was, you know, very much meeting Swami, even though I think my disparate engineering and hostel life was kind of pushing me in other directions. Somehow I kept coming to see Swami. And so it was a very mixed up time, where intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, I believed in Swami, but, you know, let me be honest, you know, I was a teenager, I was in college for the first time, I was also kind of rebelling in a way, you know, from against my parents and against, you know, some of the things Swami was asking us to do, which was good for us, but, you know, when you're a teenager, you don't always do what's good for you. And then after I dropped out of engineering, I somehow went through a phase when I found it very hard to come and take Swami's blessings. I was still praying to him. You know, I would, you know, make sure I was back home wherever I was roaming in time for Thursday bhajan and especially for Harti. So then I went through this phase after dropping out of engineering where for a couple of years I was very, very reluctant to come and see Swami. And so I spent those 2 years in Delhi. My mother had, you know, become a member of parliament, so she was living in Delhi and I was sort of accompanying there. I got my BA privately and I was, you know, applying for admissions at these places. And Swami made a gesture which meant so much to me and especially to my mother, and it healed us and gave us courage. So what happened was, I, after a couple of years in Delhi, I got admission to study journalism in IIMC, the Indian Institute of Mass Communication.
Yes.
And what happened then is a book of my poetry was published by Writer's Workshop. So that was really my first book. It was just poems I was writing in all my angst about the meaning of life. And it was published by Writer's Workshop, Kolkata, and it was a nicely designed. And unknown to me, my mother took that book and went off to Parthi. And she was, you know, as a mother, I can understand her genuine concern, you know, like, you know, she was thinking, Swami, what is going to happen to this boy? He dropped out of engineering despite all your blessings and good wishes for him. What is ever going to happen to him? Will he be all right? And so apparently she went to Bharti. This was in 1991, June or July. And she sat there and holding the book. She silently prayed. She said, Swami, if you just touch this book, I will know that you're still looking after my son and he will be all right.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what happens? Swami comes and takes the book from her.
Mm. He's more than looking after you.
Oh, my God. I mean, what else can I say?
Yeah.
No? And I was in Delhi at that time, you know, growing a beard, writing poetry, just being sad. And I remember that morning, I got a telegram from my father, and I open it, and, you know, I can see it's being sent from Prashanthi Nilaya. And the message says, Swami accepted your poetry book graciously.
Oh.
Good luck. And that message somehow, it was like force of light and purity and relief just came into me.
Mm.
And so after that, my parents, you know, knew that they had the assurance, so I joined an IMC and I did my diploma there. And then I went to the U.S. I did my master's in mass communication.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did my PhD. And I think it was really during my PhD that my real, real journey of discovery with Swami began. And that's a new phase altogether.
I see. So let's fast forward here a little bit to your recent visit to Prashanthi Nilayam for Sankranti of 2013. And I understand you came here after a gap of 5 years. And it was the very first time you were visiting Prashanthi after the Mahasamadhi. So we were reading in the Huffington Post blog that you wrote that in your opinion, everything had changed and yet nothing had changed. How do you explain that paradox?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very intense journey for me because I had been wanting and desiring to come to Bharti for the last 5 years. And after that, I mean, even though I'd come to India a couple of times, somehow, you know, as we say, Swami, you only come when Swami wants you to come.
Very true.
And so in 2010, I was here for 6 months on a sabbatical, and for whatever, you know, silly reason, and there's no other way to say, but silly reason, it did not happen, you know, I didn't go to see Swami. In 2011, April, we just had to read on the internet and in the newspapers that we will never have that privilege of seeing him in his physical form on this earth anymore. So I was very, very, you know, distraught in a way. In a way, I was very calm about it because it was like, then I realized, Swami, you have been here with us in such a way that even to what's going on right now on TV, what we are watching on the web stream is an illusion.
Mm.
But since we are so steeped in this illusion of human life, you know, we can't help crying, we can't help feeling grief, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
But so I went through, I think, the same mixed feelings that all our, you know, Sai brothers and sisters went through. And finally, this Sankranti, just a few days ago, I was able to make the trip, or Swami made sure it happened. And obviously, the first thing I realized, and people were saying this, that nothing has changed, everything is going on exactly as before, that was very evident. I mean, the first thing I could notice was the people. There were so many people there. And there were a lot of devotees, students, families, and I could see throughout the course of the day that a lot of new people were coming in, younger people were coming in. And of course, everything was going on as usual, the bhajans, the talks. So in many ways, you know, everything was the same. I think everybody was feeling and experiencing Swami's presence in many ways. But at the same time, obviously, you know, changed. I mean, just the fact that now we were not going to sit and wait to catch a glimpse of Swami and yearn to hear a word from him, you know, so that was very different. So, you know, that painful absence was also there. One could feel it in one's heart. And I don't know how to describe it, but it was very strange. In the morning Samadhi Darshan, I was very calm. I mean, I had the title page of my new book printed out, and I just took it up and kind of presented it to Swami and said, Swami, my book.
The Guru Within?
The Guru Within.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle is Sri Satya Sai Baba, My Parents, and My Reluctant Education from Engineering to Me. So I presented the book to Swami and was very professional about it, I guess. I don't know why. Then in the evening, after spending the whole day in the ashram and, you know, seeing all the old sites, I don't know what happened. In the evening, I was very, very, very overwhelmed. And because I also realized that, you know, this was the first time I was coming to see Swami after I became a father.
Mm-hmm.
In 2008, in the last visit, you know, essentially, you know, my wife and I came there with earnest prayers to Swami. for that. And, you know, 2009 it happened. And Swami has said so. Swami told my mother to tell me that a son would be born, and he was born. So I took a picture of my son to show Swami and in the evening. And at that point, I broke down because, I mean, we go through life thinking, you know, especially in the modern age, thinking that, you know, we control everything. We think that, you know, mankind has learned to fly and, you know, do so many powerful things. But ultimately, you know, we are so little before the order of nature, before reality. And it's only the master of reality, the master of nature, it is God, it is Swami, who is looking out for us, you know, and when we yearn for what is good for us and what is right for us, you know, he makes sure it happens. You know? And so when I presented the picture of my son to Swami, then I was really overwhelmed, you know, both with the, first with the gratitude, the humbling gratitude that we had the pleasure, we still have the, we have the privilege that here is a sacred being, not any sacred being, but, you know, capital S, capital V, who chose us, who brought us to him and just took care of us in so many ways. So I was overwhelmed with gratitude and also a little bit of blissful regret, you know, that I had not come sooner. But, you know, again, I assure myself now that, you know, I will see a new journey to Swami and to a better world unfolding in our children, you know, in our children, our students, you know, the next generation. That is what Swami has chosen for us, or for me, I feel.
I see. Let's talk about the ambience at Prashanthi Nilayam. Bhajan singing, music of the spheres drawn from world cultures is an integral part of what we do around here in the ashram. And I understand you're a music lover. Do you have favorite bhajans?
Yes, I think the music was a very, very special and profound part of the Sai movement and the Sai experience for me. You know, when I first came to Bharti in 1986, I remember it was before dawn, and I had never seen a place like this. The whole ashram, Prashanthi Nilayam, seemed like a living being to me. You know, it the sounds of the birds waking up at dawn, and of course, the first time I heard the Nagar Sankirtana, as the sound came closer, I mean, I had never witnessed anything like that in my life. And I remember, I think probably that was the first time I heard the Arati song. And I still remember making out the words, Mata Pita Guru Daivaman Mire Swami Antayu Mari Antayu Mire. Your mother, father, everything is you, Swami, everything is you. And I liked that very much. And then, of course, a couple of hours later when I had my first interview and meeting with Swami, that was the line which just summarized, you know, the experience of Swami for me, and it has remained the foundation. So that is a song I like very much.
The Arati song.
I like the Arati song. It started with that, but then over the years, many, many songs have become not just favorite in an aesthetic way, also in a poetic way, in a philosophical way, but also sometimes in very powerful and mystical ways. One example I'd like to share is a very rare song which even a lot of my elders from the Telugu world have not quite been able to tell me the history of, called Tandava Keli Salpane. Tandava Keli Salpane, Parameswarudu, Shambhashivudu. And this is a song that I found on a CD of songs sung by Swami in his earlier days, probably in the 1960s. So I bought the CD in Puttaparthi many years ago, and I used to listen to it, and there were many great songs in that CD, you know, sung by Swami. You know. And I know you now have it on your Radio Sai archives. I found it, and you have two or three versions, and I love all of them. And but the original one which Swami sang, perhaps was sung by him in some informal setting way back in the 60s. You know, there are some songs on that CD too, like Broche Varu, and some wonderful songs, you know, which we don't usually sing in the bhajans. You know, so that's why I said they're very rare songs. So Tandava Keli somehow really became my favorite song in the last 5 or 6 years. I have a small, beautiful Nataraja at home, and just the joy in the song, you know, and the beauty in it, because Swami, in a very different kind of Telugu, which I don't even know, you know, like classical, folksy Telugu from probably the 1930s, 40s, he's describing the dance of Shiva and everybody else, all the gods coming to watch. Ganesha is, you know, bobbing his head in joy, and Nataraja is stomping his foot, going tareem, tareem, and, you know, Trishulam is spinning. So just beautiful imagery in that song.
Very vivid, and yeah.
It's a very vivid song. And so whatever I could, you know, grasp out of it, and of course, you know, Swami and Shiva, the connection is, you know, very, very deep. And so in 2008, when my wife and I were coming to take Swami's blessings on Shivaratri Day. We went from San Francisco and we were driving from Bangalore to Patti. And I suddenly realized, you know, I had the song with me on my laptop. So we just kept hearing Tandava Keli again and again, you know, numerous times in the car as we were driving into Patti on Shivaratri afternoon. It was a blazing hot day. And that afternoon, you know, I sat, you know, Swami gave his darshan. He went in his chair very close to me. And, you know, the way I felt his presence that day was very, very powerful. I think that was the only time, or at least the first time after many years I was there on Shivaratri. And, you know, what they say about Swami being exceptionally intense on Shivaratri, it's true. You could just feel it. I mean, there was some kind of a nuclear or atomic presence about him there. I don't know how else to say it. And it went past me, and then he gave
us... I guess there's a lingam brewing inside, or many lingams. Who knows? Who would
understand? Who knows what's going on? I mean, and who knows what's... I mean, we see a little golden lingam, but who knows? Maybe the universe is inside.
Of course.
You know? And we don't really grasp these things. You know? And he went past me, and so I can... Now that you said that, I can imagine all the souls in the world, you know, like tiny specks dancing inside his, you know,
cosmic
physical body
self,
that
yes.
day.
Yes, yes.
So, and maybe that's what the tandemum is about too, you know, so making us all dance to his tune and, you know, making us better dancers, you know.
And I'm sure he experiences a lot of difficulty in making us learn each step, because sometimes we are poor learners.
Oh, yes, you're so right, you're so right. I mean, I hear from the Sai devotees, you know, like, who say, like, every time they suffer something, I say, Swami, you know, are you also feeling this, you know? And so that's a very good reason for us not to harm other people and also not to harm ourselves, you know? Yeah. Because whatever, you know, when we're nice to ourselves, you know, I'm sure it reaches Swami too. So, and so the coincidence about the song, and so Swami goes back and he gives his discourse. And you listen to the Swami's discourse, Shivaratri 2008. You will find that a few minutes into his talk, he suddenly starts to sing a song which I know he has very rarely ever referred to in his discourses, as far as I know, and that is Tandava Keli. So,
what do you know?
I mean, here is a very rare song which we rarely sing in the bhajans, as far as I know. I listen to it as I'm coming into Patti, and then suddenly, you know, he sings that song, you know, and he sang a few lines and said, Swami, what, I mean, forgive me, but what are you? How do you know this? You know, what are you giving me here? What kind of a blessing are you, you know, just putting on me over here? And why do I deserve it? You know, and I don't know. Okay, I'll just do my best. You help me do my best to live up to whatever it is, whatever grace you're giving to me. And so that's the one amazing song story.
Well, it is, indeed. Now, Vamsi, if I ask you to just step back a little, and you are a novelist, an author, and you're a professor of media studies right now at the University of San Francisco. So, perched where you are right now, what do you perceive of the Sai movement from there?
Oh, I've started to see the Sai movement in a very different way in the last few years. Because
Why in the last few years?
I think before I was very, you know, comfortable and happy just being a, you know, a Sai devotee and having had the privilege of counting on Swami's blessings and also appreciating his teachings.
I see.
But my education and now my career as a writer and and as a public intellectual has somehow made the Sai movement very central to my attention and also an inspiration to me. And when I was doing my PhD, when I began to read Swami's teachings very, very earnestly, especially Vidya Vahini and Jnana Vahini. And with all these books and of course Swami's own very unique take on the Bhagavad Gita, I somehow found that what I was doing in my academic work and what Swami was teaching me through his teachings were all coming together in some strange way. And, you know, I never really wrote about the Sai movement after that, but I feel Swami's values and teachings, whether it's a ceiling on desires or the need for education to really be about changing people's hearts, most of all for religious tolerance, for recognizing that the divine is the same, regardless of whatever name and form we call it by. All these values, I thought, were very, very important to the world at that time in the 90s.
And how was MTV contributing to them in India?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, my research was actually very different from the business management, media approach to it. So
making media better? Making media more responsible?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So then, what are your thoughts on media and ethics? Do you think the twain will ever meet?
I think it will. It's happening in little ways, you know. So, for example, the university where I teach, University of San Francisco, our motto is, you know, educating hearts and minds to change the world. So we are educating students who will have some practical skills, you know, no doubt, you know, with painting and blogging and journalism. But there's a lot of emphasis on giving them the intellectual tools to have a sound worldview. And of course, ethics is a very important part of that worldview. So my research and now my teaching too is all about the influence that the media has on the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we teach our students to recognize that the stories the media tell about the world, whether it was MP in India or the new Hollywood movies or news, and most importantly these days, the way the media are covering spiritual and religious news, and particularly Swami, you know, these are all very, very flawed narratives, you know, for various structural reasons, whether it's commercialism or political agendas. For the most part, media today have been very unethical, unprofessional, and untrue. And my field and my job, I feel, as a scholar and a media professional, as a writer, is to combat that. So that's the reason why now the Sai movement looks very different to me. So in the last three or four years, you know, I have started to write about Swami and his legacy as somebody who has had the privilege to see it, but also as a commentator on religion in the world today. Because I look at religion as a form of culture, and I can see how the way the media presents religion has become highly distorted. I mean, on the one hand, we have a few fundamentalists and extremists who have this very literal, intolerant understanding of religion.
Okay, let me just jump the gun here slightly, because you're talking about writing for mainstream. You have a book in the pipeline, as we talked about earlier, The Guru Within, which is going to be published next year. What is it like being a writer and writing about Swami and contemporary religion today?
Something that has become very, very dear to me now in two ways. You know, till now Swami was in my heart, and I wrote letters to Swami, and now I want to write about Swami for the whole world. Not only for Sai brothers and sisters and elders but also for the mainstream, because I want to somehow make the world understand and recognize, not because we need it in any selfish way, Swami needs nothing, but because I feel it is in the good of humanity for everyone, every educated, intelligent, well-meaning person, to just recognize what religion is about, you know, in a good way, and what Swami's legacy has been about. Because, you know, whether they come to Swami or not, or whether they become devotees or not, whether they see Swami as, you know, an avatar or only as a humanitarian, whatever it is, that is their spiritual journey. You know, we can't impose. But I want the record to be set straight, because I think humanity will gain so much by understanding what exactly Swami's contribution has been. You know, not just as a god and a guru, but, you know, as a poet, as a playwright, as a cultural figure. I mean, and the number of people he has encouraged, you know, whether it's cricket players or singers or writers, it's all going to happen now. And I think the Sai movement is going to be at the forefront of just bringing love and enlightenment to the world. That's my real belief.
It's good to hear that. Now, as a media specialist, what is your take on effective message dissemination process? We've seen the flawed narrative, and we talked about it. So what would make for an effective message dissemination process?
You know, I take a very long view on this, because I have been thinking about this question about when is the media ever going to tell a better story about the world? When is it going to represent human beings as they really are and they really ought to be? Because the problem with the media right now is because we have a hugely commercial media system. I mean, most of the media in the world is owned by 5 or 6 companies. Hundreds of billions of dollars, and you know, more and more creativity is being stifled, and the same old cultural trash is being reproduced, whether it's ultra-violent movies or sensational news and scandals, all these things. So for that to change, I think the longer view I take is that we need better human beings to go into the media, people with a sense of passion, and that's where I think the Sai movement and the children of Sai devotees and anybody who's had any kind of a association with Swami's legacy should start thinking about expressing themselves, whether try and go into careers in the media, try and go into careers which outside of engineering and medicine.
In medicine, I was going to say that, yes.
Yeah. I mean, those are very, very useful, but, you know, we need Sai students to study sociology and history and politics and economics. We need Sai students writing in the mainstream newspapers and in the media. So for me, that is, the long-term view. The more you have good people with good hearts going into these fields, then, that's the best way to change the media from within. We are going to get media ethics, and we're going to harness the power of the media. I mean, the media is such a powerful force. Mm-hmm. And, one of the amazing things, I'm seeing this as a media observer, about the Sai movement, which a lot of, I think, new people don't usually appreciate, Swami built this world, this army of devoted hearts or yearning seekers. He built this whole world without the media.
No media. Swami was totally averse to any kind of propaganda, nothing.
Yes, yes.
PR department. There was no formal ever. It was just one Swami heart-to-heart connection with millions. It's just an incredible phenomenon.
Yeah, and sometimes some of the new media critics, I think, sometimes they feel spurned, and maybe that's why they kind of, get away, try to write, patently untrue and unprofessional stuff. But it doesn't matter, I think in the end, love wins, that's what Swami has taught us. And now,
love winning, you're a professor of communication. What grade would you award Radio Sai, Swami's own radio station?
I consider myself, and let me make myself an intern in Radio Sai, a long-distance intern, because I cannot grade Radio Sai, because I'll just be a fellow traveler and learner with you. Anyway, but since you asked me the question, I think the standards of Radio Sai are very, very high. I listen to it very regularly, and, I see so many wonderful things. I mean, the passion and the clarity and the simple, humility and, no-nonsense way in which, the spirit of the Sai movement is being, kept alive 24 hours a day. So I will make this a non-gradable question, but yes, this Radio Sai gets my highest compliments.
Well, we'll pass on your comments to the entire team. Appreciate that. Now, your thoughts on the everlasting impact of Sai Avatar on the destiny of humanity. Zoom out, and what do you see?
I think the Sai legacy is going to be the one thing that is going to stand between humanity and total self-destruction. And I think it's already happened. When you think about it, the last 100 to 200 years of mm-hmm. human history have been the most systematically violent, cruel, and destructive ones in human history. But for each of these problems, Swami has already told us, he has inoculated us, he has informed us. Now, Swami was telling us about what animals of the world are feeling for the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
Swami was telling us about what consumerism is doing to the world.
He was an advocate for everybody's rights, women's rights, animal rights, planet rights.
Well, you're absolutely right. And minority rights, everything.
Everything.
It's all there. It's all there. So Swami, he gave us whole spectrum of work, in a very, very intellectual sense. And then, of course, he gave us the institutions. I mean, as a professor, I marvel at what Swami has, built, and he has brought out the best in so many human beings who volunteer and who represent Sai ideals wherever they are. And then, of course, there is a mystical, supreme sacred presence and energy which we can only fathom, So I feel that Swami's presence on this earth came at a time when, things were really, really bad. And if things have not gone even worse, it's because he was here, he spent his lifetime on earth with us, the supreme divinity, like Krishna or Rama or by any other name. And, he has given us like this massive, massive infusion of pure selfless love. And, that is going to now, manifest itself in all sorts of new ways. And for me, as an intellectual, one thing I would really like to see happening, and I think it will happen, is a lot of young scholars and commentators looking at Swami very objectively and intellectually and realizing and recognizing that, that what Swami was teaching was very, very profound. It was, seemingly very simple, and I would like to, point out to, some of our brothers and sisters who may not know Telugu that, Swami's profundity sometimes in translation seems very simple, which is fine because that's the way he always wanted it. He didn't want anybody to put on intellectual airs. But in Telugu, when you feel the flavor of Swami's words...
Oh, I'm sure it's hard to capture the fine nuances once you translate.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets lost.
Yeah, I think it was. And that's why, I feel very blessed and, that Swami you know, granted me my wish of being a writer and gave me a journey from which to draw on my experiences and now come back through my writing and through conversations like this to rediscovering Swami's importance intellectually to the world, you know. And I think when the world starts to appreciate objectively, you know, the mainstream readers and listeners, they will just gain so much from everything that Swami has done.
Yes,
and said.
Very true. And we really look forward to more articles and submissions from your end in mainstream media, both American and Indian, so that the world will hear greater glories of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. It's been great talking to you, Brother Vamsi, and I hope with His grace our paths will cross so that together we can bring greater glory to Him.
Thank you once again, and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram. Sai Ram, and welcome back to Radio Sai. You're tuned to Morning Glory on Thursday Live on January the 31st, 2013. My name is Karuna. You just heard a telephone interview with Dr. Vamsi Jaluri, a professor of media studies at the University of San Francisco in the U.S. Dr. Jaluri's blog on the Huffington Post of January the 16th had caught our attention, and we managed to catch up with him before he left India last week, and that's how we were able to record this conversation over the phone. So, dear listeners, what are your thoughts on Dr. Jaluri's interview? We look forward to your feedback. Please keep your emails coming. They inspire us to keep working harder each week, because Bhagwan is the voice, the listener, and the heart of Radio Sai. And when we hear from you, we take it as Bhagwan's feedback to us. So please don't forget to email us at listener@radiosai.org. Sai's glory, His divine story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Sai Ram, and thank you for staying tuned to Morning Glory. It's now time for our feature presentation. This Fleeting Moments interview is yet to air on Asia Stream, even though we have played it on Afri and Ameri Streams earlier on. Here, then, is the thought-provoking and insightful conversation with Mr. S. Sriram, the former band leader of the Sai University and his alumnus, and here he is talking to Radio Sai's Mr. Bishu Prushti.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories, our series of conversations with former students of Baba's educational institutions, wherein they reminisce and reflect on the moments they have spent being a student in Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, or the Sri Sathya Sai Primary School, or the Sri Sathya Sai Higher Secondary School. And today, we have with us Brother S. Sriram. Sriram joined the Prashantiniram campus of Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning in 1997 for his bachelor's in sciences, specializing in mathematics. He followed this up with his master's in mathematics, and after this he switched discipline when he got selected to do MBA, master's in business administration, in the same university. And after basking in Bhagwan's proximity for 7 years, he left the portals of his college in the year 2004. As a student, he was very active, being a member of the Prashanti Bhajan group as well as the university's brass band. And thanks to his multifarious talents as a singer, speaker, conductor of music, composer, and so on, he did have innumerable opportunities to offer his proficiencies to Swami, and also as a gift has had many indelible moments with Bhagwan. And today we seek to capture a few of those slices from his life which remain evergreen in his memory and continue to inspire him even now. Interestingly, he is currently a full-time hypnotherapist and healer based in Bangalore. And yes, I should mention this. He was the band leader of the Institute brass band for 2 years. And his love for these instruments have only increased exponentially with time. Today, he is one of the founding members of the band group Rhythmic Energy, a group of former students of Baba's University who are passionate about spreading the message of love through the medium of music. So, they play for them who need love the most, the terminally ill, the destitute, the impoverished, the sick, and the depressed. They have even recently produced an album, The One. And the other good news, they have been awarded with the title The Ultimate Fusion Band 2011 at the Break Free Music Fest organized by Forum and Radio 1 94.3 FM in Bangalore. The love in their music is indeed making waves, touching hearts and soothing souls. So there's plenty to hear from Sri Ram. A warm welcome to you, brother, to the studios of Radio Sai.
Sai Ramvel.
So you have been engaged now in music, healing and love. You've been a hypnotherapist now for probably 2-3 years.
Yeah, it's the fourth year.
Fourth year. And you have also been now engaged in music. And I don't know what are the other things that you're really busy with, because you being such a multi-talented personality. But I want to ask you this. You were always a dynamic person, even when you were here as a student. From where is all this energy, all this inspiration coming from?
I think like every other student, the one thing that makes all of us step up and do something and try to stand out from a crowd is to be noticed by Swami. And that is one thing that has kept all of us during college days and even now practically on our toes. So every time I try to do something new, it has been more with this intent that I want to do something that will please Swami. And as part of the band, I've had these moments when we give a performance and Swami used to just sit there beaming with a lot of pride. So many times I just visualize this thing that, you know, when I do something really good, I can just imagine Swami beaming with pride. And that is the motivating factor. That's behind every single thing that we do. And I'm sure this is the truth with every student.
So when Bhagwan was physically there to receive that smile from Swami was in fact the single most motivation for every student. So take us back to your days of those beautiful memories with Bhagwan. And after that we'll come to how you see his smile even now. That is a different chapter. That is also, I know, very interesting and revealing. But we'll probably come to that towards the later part of this session. Take us back to your days with Bhagwan.
The first time I came here after I grew up was, even though I grew up in a family that was devoted to Swami, I had always seen Swami in photographs and related to him as God, just like any other God like Ganesha or Vishnu. After my 12th standard, I had come to Parthi for the first time. And at that time, I saw Swami for the first time in the physical form and not just as a photograph. And for the first time, I realized that God is not to be feared, but is to be loved. And there was so much of love pouring out from Swami.
So what really did happen? Is just that darshan?
Yes, it was actually just the darshan. I had come here more on a personal visit to see my grandmother who used to stay in Parthi. But just unknowingly, I walked into darshan hall and as Swami willed it, I was in the first row. Swami came and stood right in front of me and he seemed to have dropped his set of letters, whatever he had in his hand. And first I thought I should help him by picking up those letters, but there were so many hands already doing it. And then I realized that, you know, for a few fleeting moments, it was just me looking at Swami, and he was just beaming a big, wonderful smile at me, full of love. And I was taking his Padnamaskar, then sitting and looking at his face, and it was amazing. I did this 3 times, and all the while, you know, he just kept smiling. And after that, practically, I just couldn't go back. You know, and I still remember, even as a student, I found it quite difficult to go back home for vacations.
That's interesting. Of course, that is a common experience for many students.
Yeah.
So that is when love for Swami actually began to emerge.
Yes.
From your heart.
Yes. And then as a student, a lot of things that I had heard as theories started like really becoming a reality. You know, for the first time, I could see how much of care and concern Swami used to have for his boys and for everybody in general, but especially for his boys, I could notice it. And Swami keeps saying these words that, you know, my life is my message. And many a time I would take his words quite literally and try to understand it by observing. It was just an innate habit with me. So I started observing how Swami was treating people, how he would just live his life and how he would do things. And to this day, I feel that he has given an example for everything in our lives. Whatever we want to do, if we want to know how to do it, I think if we just close our eyes and look back as to how Swami would have done it, we will get some really wonderful practical tips on how to live life.
I think that is such a powerful observation that you made, because even for me, when I look at Swami's life in the light of this message of Bhagwan, my life is my message. In fact, the whole 86 years of Bhagwan's earthly sojourn acquires a completely different meaning. You begin to connect so many dots about why Swami did a particular thing at that point in time.
Yes.
You know, when you connect each of these years and you know the dots keep connecting even now.
Yes, correct.
Wonderful. So tell us, what were the kind of revelations, the lessons that you kept on getting as you observed Swami?
One of the first things I noticed was that he had a lot of appreciation for sincerity. Because when I joined college, I had nothing to do with music in my life until that point in time. But I realized that music group boys used to get this opportunity to sit very close to Swami. So I started learning music from my seniors and started
practicing. So you were not a singer even in your school days?
No, I wasn't. So I started practicing music. And when Swami gave me permission to start singing in Mandir, and even after that many times I've realized that he has always encouraged me because of the sincere efforts that I had put in at that time. And that is something that I always believed in. I still remember there was a classmate of mine whom I considered as a better singer than me, but who had not already got permission to sing in Mandir. And one day, you know, he was talking to me about music, and I told him that you have a much better voice, you can sing far, far better than me, and you should be singing in Mandir. But in my personal opinion, I think you must start practicing, because that is what will get you that opportunity. And he had just taken my words, and after a few days he came back and told me that, you know what happened today? There was a drama practice going on. He was a card room boy and he was part of sets. And so he said that there was a moment when it looked like there was nobody within earshot. It was just Swami and him, you know, behind the stage. And in that moment, he had just got up and asked Swami, "Swami, can I sing in Mandir?" And Swami's response was, "You practice and I will let you sing." So he came back and told me that what you said was so true. Swami told me that you practice and I will let you sing. So for me, it was also a reiteration that Swami looks for what you have in your heart. So it didn't have to do really with talent, you know, because I would have considered that he's a better singer than me. But then Swami always wanted that sincere yearning from your heart, and then he would grant you whatever you wanted.
Fantastic. And I think that is a common experience of so many students. You spend days preparing for a program in front of Swami.
Yes.
And sometimes on the final day, it may not be really as breathtaking as probably you would have imagined it to be. For the crowd, it may not be anything really extraordinary, but for Swami, it is the biggest drama ever.
Yes.
And he blesses you like that.
Correct.
Because as you mentioned, he alone knows what has gone within each person's mind who has been part of that. And you've been part of so many performances. Yeah, so just give us more instances of those moments.
The first thing that comes to my mind is a band performance for a New Year program, in which for the first time we tried to do something that was very different from our regular pieces. So in that year we played Santorini, which is a Yanni's composition. And then we played Symphony No. 40. And then we played Love Story. And these three were very different kinds of pieces, very technically difficult for a band that up to that point in time had played predominantly 3x4 or 4x4 marches only. And concert pieces also, and typically 4x4, you know. So it was a very different thing, trying to play different beats and everything. And we put in a lot of hard work, a lot of hard work. But on that day, since I was a bass drummer and I was at the back, you know, playing percussions, so I can stand and listen to the music that is being played. And I remember that on Jan 1st, we probably played a lot more, you know, not so nice and not so correct notes than we would like to, you know. And I just kept waiting to see what would be the reaction from Swami. But he enjoyed the program so much. And in Parthi, one thing I've noticed is when Swami enjoys, it almost seems to rub off on everybody else, and everybody enjoys the program, you know. And I'm sure that maybe technically only musicians may have made out the mistakes that we had made on that day. But then it is still a mistake. But Swami just seemed to brush it all aside. And in fact, he came all the way and gave us a photograph where we were standing. It was a very emotional moment when Swami came. And then I realized that for him, what really matters is the heart with which you're playing your music. You know, so he probably would have been the one person who understood that we had gone way beyond our abilities and capabilities as of that point in time, you know, because he would have realized that, yes, these people are trying to play a different beat, which they just have no idea about. He would have understood to that degree of sensitivity and love.
Yes. In fact, today is Jan 11th. The annual sports and cultural meet in the morning session is over, and I think as you are mentioning about this performance, about Swami always acknowledging the effort, I think the sports meet is the biggest example of that.
Yes. Correct.
You try to do so many different things only for Swami, and he's the one who's always behind you, who's in front of you, behind you, and he's the one who's actually acknowledging all the efforts. Fantastic. The other thing that you mentioned about after having come to Bhagwan's University is this blossoming of talent, of your talent. Because I know of so many students who probably did not know, like yourself, you know, did not know that they can do a particular thing. But it is only Swami who would kind of instigate in them, and then they would blossom into different facets of their personality. So how was this experience in your life, apart from singing? Or maybe in singing also, you went ahead, you sang so many kind of different songs, and you incorporated music and a bit of music and singing into band.
The first thing that comes to my mind is the fact that over here, it's a very different scenario, where the word brother, which people use to address each other, is something that they mean at some very deep level. You know, because on one hand, if you look at it, it's almost like everybody's competing with each other for, you know, attention from Swami or the opportunity to sing or perform in front of him. But at the same time, people so willingly help each other. It is something that's amazing, and I felt extremely grateful for that opportunity. And to this day, whenever I meet those brothers who taught me music for the first time anywhere outside, let's say in our own cities, etc., I do make it a point to tell them that I'm very grateful to you because you have been the one who has taught me these things in the first place. Like, they have started by telling me there are 7 notes, Sarigama Padani, and started with that kind of, and spent so many hours for nothing other than the satisfaction that they are helping a brother. So that is one thing that I'm very grateful for, and it's there in every field, whether it is sports or arts or whatever it may be.
Yes.
You know, so that is one thing. The second thing is that, along with that, I think the greatest thing is the motivation that we feel whenever we think that we are doing this for Swami. And probably the greatest lesson is to try to somehow apply that to our day-to-day lives. And I did try this at some point in time when I was working in a corporate world. And there were times when I was able to do it, there were times when I was not able to do it. It was quite difficult. But then in the times when I could do it, I realized that this is probably something that I must inculcate if I wanted my life to be extremely meaningful. Because many times we feel that our best times in lives was that period which we were, you know, spending as students in Swami's college. But then in a way that is like restricting ourselves in a very narrow-minded way. Probably Swami may not be so happy with it. Every moment of our life, if we could live like when we were students, that would be amazing. Everything that we did when we were students was somehow centered around Swami. You know, it had to be at that level. So let's say that we made a card. We would make the card so extremely beautiful and, you know, everything perfect about it before we take it to Swami. So if you had to make the same card 4 times, you will make it 4 times till it is at that level of, you know, perfection. So when we practice music also, we do the same thing. So in a similar way, imagine how many times when we work in our corporate worlds, or let's say when I do my healing work or something like that, how often do we try to achieve that level of perfection? Do we make presentation to that level of perfection as if we are going to show the presentation to Swami? So probably that is one thing that we all need to carry, that I also need to remind myself every time. So when we do that, I think life is far more fulfilling.
That is what is Karma Yoga is all about.
Yes, yes, correct.
And that is what is ultimately the summum bonum of Swami's teachings in one way, where Swami says ultimately to see the oneness in all, and that perfection and that interest in work comes when you want to see the other person consciously as someone of your own. He's like, he's another God.
Yes.
He's another Swami.
Yes.
So only I think when you have that kind of a perspective does this feeling emerge, and that translates into work.
Correct.
Wonderful. I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about observing Swami. You know, you mentioned about one particular facet from Swami's life that you saw and you imbibed. Give us more.
It also happened when Swami was addressing a small group of us once and said something, these are not the exact words, but which meant something to the effect that all right, I know that you've heard a lot of theories and you've heard a lot of discourses and everything. For now, what I would suggest is just set that aside. Just watch me and learn from me. This was one thing which just stuck in my mind, and then I started observing him even more closely. So what I realized was this, that Swami is genuine, extremely genuine. There was once a person who gave a talk about his cat that passed away. And now I have a pet at my home and I really can, you know, relate to what he felt. But at that point in time, I had never had pets in my life and I could not relate to the concept of, you know, why is this person talking in front of Swami, a golden opportunity, about something that seems so trivial. But when I looked at Swami, he had, you know, that feeling. He looked at this person with so much compassion, with so much of feeling that, yeah, I know what pain you're going through. And then I realized that he's extremely genuine and very compassionate. What you said is very true. Just a few minutes back, you said that able to understand that person's life and everything as if you are that person, right? So Swami is feeling that every moment. So he was able to feel everything. So there's nothing trivial for him. Which also tells us that whenever we go and tell Swami, sometimes if you look at this heart-to-heart or, you know, the student interactions with Swami, they seem to be on trivial topics. But actually they are not. Because it's in those small things that Swami has actually interwoven his life and our life to a great extent. That was the first thing that I noticed, that he's very genuine, very compassionate. Another thing that I realized was, Swami is a person who is in the moment. He could watch the same drama 100 times, and each time his level of concentration and involvement with the drama would be the same, which probably even the actors may not feel. You know, the ones who are staging the drama may not have felt that much, but he would feel it. He would be watching the same thing, and sometimes I used to wonder, how can you do it? But then now, in retrospect, when I look at it, I realize that there are two things to it. Number one is, he's in the moment. Whereas many times we tend to be either in the past or into the future. We are thinking of the past events or projecting a future event and trying to imagine things. But how often do we like really stay in the current moment? So that is one thing that I noticed. Swami is really in the moment. And the second thing is, he relates to whatever is happening in front of him with utmost involvement. So if, let us say, somebody is portraying Swami Vivekananda and Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, he is in that moment as if he is really in front of the real Swami Vivekananda and Paramahamsa. So it is to that extent of involvement. So maybe for us, the takeaways would be that we also start being in the moment. And as a therapist, I keep telling people who come with problems that many times the problems are either projections of the future causing worry or, you know, imprints of the past. And I tell people, stop all that and just be in the now. So that is another thing that I really noticed about Swami, that you be in the now. A third thing that stood out for me was that the way Swami was a leader. These days, so many of us say that we are busy with our life and things like that. We have this entire talk about work-life balance and things like that. And sometimes to me it just occurs that, what are we really talking about? If you look at it at the physical plane, Swami was running hospitals that run at a magnitude that is immense, in educational institutions at an immensely large scale, water projects and so many other service activities which are at a very, very, very high scale. And still, as a student, we know that he gave us his time.
Plenty of time. Yes. What you're mentioning is so fantastic. I mean, at that point in time, we never realized that this person who comes and spends with us like 2 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours, he actually has to run all these institutions. Which other person in the world would have ever done such a thing?
So when I look at that part of Swami and then I look at my own life and try to think, how can we inculcate this, then I suddenly start finding that, you know, this very concept of maybe thinking or talking about work-life balance and everything almost seems like a trivial thing, because we have not even reached 1% of what Swami has done. You know, not that level, that magnitude of things. Which means that if we have to take a takeaway from Swami's life and his example, we have to start living life in such a manner that our family members don't even know the extent of work and success that we are achieving. Because that is what Swami did with us. Like how you said, we were never aware, or it never occurred to us that he is running institutions of such magnitude. Because with us, he was like a child playing with us. Now as a father or a son or a brother or even a sister or mother, what we can learn and inculcate is to be there. When we are there with our children, again it's about being in that moment. if you are completely there in the moment, then they would feel your presence so much that they would never ever feel that you are not giving them time.
That is so powerful, because he was always in the moment. So he was, as you mentioned, he was a child among children, because he was always, as you mentioned, in that moment. As you observe every facet of Swami's life now, everything becomes such a powerful life lesson. And I think the 7 years that you have spent, if you take even every chapter of your life here, each day perhaps will bring back so many instances. There will be so many instances where Swami would have just told you one word or one glance, and that would have meant so much for you. Maybe you can take us back to some more of those moments when Swami probably asked you to speak. I think you spoke in front of Bhagwan for a couple of occasions.
Yeah, I spoke on 2 occasions exactly. One was when Swami was giving a lot of opportunities for boys to come and speak in the evenings. It was like almost a random thing, but we know that randomness is not as random as it seems. So that was one. And another was during a New Year when Swami asked me to speak. Those were the 2 opportunities. And I'm not an orator per se, so I don't really speak a formal language. So I'm very grateful to Swami that he has given me the opportunity to express myself from my heart, and he appreciated it. And at that time, there was one point that I had said during one of those impromptu speeches, which I still consider as something that I take away in my life for living every moment with confidence. And it is to do with the point of confidence only. I had heard one of my seniors tell me this, and it left a lasting impression. He mentioned that when you give a speech in front of Swami, or when he asks you to give a talk, you stand and then suddenly you're facing like so many thousands of people all facing you. And in that moment, if you're just aware, and if you just turn and look to your side, you realize that there's one person who's with you facing all of them. You know? And that is the only person that probably seems to count and who can give you that amount of confidence which can make you talk in front of n number of people. And that is the same concept that we can apply in our lives. So yes, at times it feels like, you know, we are going and doing things and there are so many thousands of people watching us or interacting with us. But at every moment we have to remember that Swami is with us, going through the same things.
This reminds me of Professor Kasturi's life when Swami asked him to take his mother and his wife and go on a pilgrimage after he kind of retired from the service. Swami told him, buy 3 tickets, but 4 will travel. And there were so many occasions during that entire trip where he kept on, you know, receiving these invisible messages from Bhagwan. You know, a telegram would go to a host's house as if it is a message from Bhagwan. Even Kasturi's name would not be there. It's almost like Swami's name is there. Yeah. There are so many occasions like that. And the point that you made is so powerful, in the sense that if we know that every time we are faced with something or we are up to something, we are not alone. Like the famous saying where they say, when you have any problem, you should not say that, oh my God, this is a problem. You should always say that, oh problem, I have a big God. So, I mean, that really puts things in such a beautiful perspective. So tell us more about those moments with Swami, as well as your moments in the hostel. Because hostel is, again, a very different experience, because our hostel, the Satya Sai hostel, is very different, I guess, from many other hostels. What are your beautiful memories from your days in the hostel?
Hostel is an amazing place, you know. Every student will vouch for this. And it's not just because of the groundnut chutney and, you know, other delicacies. It's really an amazing place where you can be yourself. There is no air of or a need to put up a guard or, you know, create a wall around yourself. People are so genuine. It's amazing. And you're also having to interact with people, students and teachers alike, who are so extremely good at what they do. It just inculcates a certain sense of humility and reality inside you. You know, at one point in time, it happened that I was working in an office in which I was part of a music group, and people seemed to look up to me in that music group because at that time I was probably the most knowledgeable in that group. And people kept telling me that, how come you're pretty, you know, modest and you don't have any airs about you? And I found that quite strange, you know. And then I told them, you know what, I've always been around such immensely great musicians that I've never had a reason to feel or believe that I have to put up any airs, you know. You can't, because you are really among people. And they are so humble. You know, we have teachers like Thalisa, who plays harmonium. He's a genius. The speed at which he can play and the way he has played, it has been very captivating.
Any number of compositions that have been sung.
His compositions are amazing. The Kavalis and everything. And recently we did a Vijayakross time, the alumni album for Swami, in which we took songs composed by students, and we also had Kavalis. At that time we had to take the composed music and arrange it for newer instrumentation and things like that. And then we realized the, you know, technical nuances and what a beautiful composition it is. And those people just walk with so much humility. You know, they have no airs about them. They are absolutely grounded and they are extremely peaceful, very approachable. And that is one thing that really stands out with our hostel. And not only teachers, even boys. There are so many boys who are extremely great people and very, very great talents, if you look at it that way. But they are very humble, very down-to-earth and approachable. Another thing that I look at from a healer point of view is that, you know, now I tend to think more in terms of the vibrations around a person and the vibrations of the person and things like that. And I realized one reason why our hostel stands out is that in the hostel, the energy level is always high. You just can't be, you can't afford to be like, you know, a loner or in a negative frame of mind for long. Because no matter what, you're always among people and your friends, you know, they come and say, what brother, what's wrong with you? And they don't let you go into a depressed state. And probably that's one simple thing that we can take away even for our lives. Wherever we are, if we have like-minded people around us, then probably at no point problems will kind of overwhelm you. It's not that people when they were in their student days didn't have problems, but at no point in time a problem seemed big. Even huge issues back at home would not seem so big as long as you were a student here in Parthi. There are many times when even as a devotee, let's say when I have come here and even with others I've heard that when they enter Parthi, it seems like as if everything has just lifted off. You know, and it is because of the fact that this entire place has that vibration. This place's energies are really high because of the happiness with which people live there. And that is where when I heard this, you know, this motto or this line written somewhere in Vrindavan Hostel, I believe, which was quoted in a speech for the first time when I heard it, I thought it's really true, where each lives for the other and all live for God, is so true.
Fantastic. In fact, as you're talking about hostel days, I was reminded of my initial days in the hostel. One day there is this classmate who comes to the room and he's jubilant. He's so happy. And when I find out the reason, it is because another classmate has done something wonderful. He's achieved something. Yes. Okay, and I was like so taken aback. Okay, that person has achieved this, but what is making this guy feel so ecstatic about it? It was kind of a very, very revealing experience for me, even as a little boy. And I thought, you know, if you have that kind of a perspective in life, you'll probably never feel sad, because others' joy becomes your joy. There is something, as you mentioned, I think all these factors contribute to that energy component that you mentioned. As a healer, you are able to see it now, but I think that is what keeps the whole mood and spirit buoyant in the hostel.
Yes, and I also feel that it's a very genuine feeling from within, because
yes,
I was probably not among the sharpest when it came to academics, and I'm very grateful to three of my classmates who on their own, you know, they just came back to hostel one day and told me that, you know what, I'm good at this subject and I know that you need help, so I will help you. So I practically had like tuition classes in the hostel run by my own friends and my own classmates for no reason other than the fact that they felt that I should not suffer. That genuine concern has always been there. So those kind of things, you know, little things in the hostel between boys is amazing.
Fantastic. In fact, and as you were talking also about Sally sir and humility, you know, that is another thing which again is so much deeply imprinted in my mind. When I joined and I saw Sally sir, and I saw how capable he is, even at that time, you know, you would see how well he taught the subject. Even though I was not a physics student, but I used to hear from my classmates how well he used to teach, and I used to see him as a person, you know, the kind of discipline and of course his talent. And at that time itself, you know, the kind of feeling that came to me very strongly was, if at all I have to become anything in life, I should become like him. If you can be someone who is so good, who is so talented, and yet can be so humble, yes, and lead a life just to make others' lives brighter, that is something phenomenal. And I think all these things rub off. As they say, a kid learns more from what he sees, yes, than what he's taught or what he reads. Ultimately, what he sees, he imbibes. And I think the culture in the hostel is what makes you a large part of it.
And maybe a lot of people like to say that kids learn from what they see, maybe because most of the people who are saying this are adults and they tend to run away from that, you know, thing. But then I believe that even now we, yes, all see and learn, yes, rather,
yes,
than,
yes,
hear and learn or listen and learn.
And it comes back to what you mentioned in the beginning. Whatever Swami said, because he was doing that,
yes,
we really fell in love with him and his teachings.
Yes, very true.
Beautiful. Let me now go to your days in the college, because you spent almost 7 years in the college. You did your BSc, you did your MSc. Then what prompted you to join for MBA?
Honestly, I actually wanted to do an MBA right from the start. Maybe from my 10th standard, I had this thing that I would want to be a successful businessman. That, mm-hmm, was what I wanted to do.
But you landed up in mathematics.
Yes. Mathematics, in a sense, the MSc was also because it gave me 2 more years to be with Swami. And that would be the most honest reason for having done an MSc. Otherwise, I would have wanted to do an MBA immediately after my BSc. Yeah. So the MSc was also 2 more years. In retrospect, I can always, like, you know, whenever we look back, we can tend to kind of connect the dots. And when I do that, I realize that the times in my mathematics classes have given me one thing which really stands out. So we had a few teachers, like one of them is CGN sir, who was very, very,
sir.
Yes, Jagan Mohan sir, who was very, 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 you know, systematic. Like every class would start with him giving a summary of practically whatever we have done so far, and then we would have a class, and at the end of the class he would again give a little summary of what we learned on that day. And you know, this is like, it's amazing. You have to be a part of the class to really understand the level to which this systematic procedure was. And I think, in a sense, a part of it got rubbed off into me. So even now, when I work with my healing modalities, I'm pretty structured. I'm very, very clear about how I start, what I do. I help people resolve their issues with all the strength and whatever convictions they have in the physical world today, in spite of the problems, and then try to use something like a past life regression or anything else as a bonus to add to it. And every time I keep tending to, you know, tie it off. So every time we meet, so we tend to learn whatever we have done so far, do something new, learn something new, and then again summarize it. So that kind of an attitude of clarity, I think, has come from my mathematics. And MBA also helped me a lot, especially with regards to my confidence building. So I think that it made me a very honest, sincere, and very confident person. So even when I'm learning things, it's not like I approach learning with any diffidence or any kind of feeling of inferiority. I go with the confidence that, yes, I'm here to learn more. I'm a seeker. And that has helped me a lot. So it makes me more open-minded to learning new things.
And you were in the corporate world for some time, but then you moved to now full-time doing hypnotherapy and helping people with their problems, healing them. How did this change happen?
So I always felt that I should be working with people. And even as a businessman, I somehow had this little image in my mind that I would be working with people, being a team leader or a manager or something like that. And although it was not clear in my mind during my college days as to what that field would be, but I always wanted to work with people. When I worked in the corporate, it was a very satisfying experience in one sense, but then it had more to do with processes and I wasn't really doing anything to help someone directly. And this thought kept nagging me in the back of my mind saying that you're not where you're supposed to be. So when I went for the hypnotherapy course, I went more to just learn about myself. I used whatever they were teaching to work with myself. That's how I began. And in the initial stages, I still remember that I had quit my job and I used to keep telling people that I'm not a therapist. I know how to do it. And I still had a lot of people coming by word of mouth. They used to hear about me and then come and say that I have this problem, can you help me? And I would help. And slowly I went to a point where, you know, after about 8 or 10 months of doing this, I was once driving to Parthi and suddenly it just occurred to me that maybe I'm living a lie by telling people that I'm not a therapist, because 80% of my time was spent on this. When I just looked back at those 8 or 10 months, I realized that I was very, very satisfied. I was directly helping people, and every time somebody would come with a problem and go back having resolved it, it used to give them and me immense pleasure. So I was very happy doing it. And since the concept of seva is also ingrained in us, it also further strengthened my feeling that I should move into this as a full-time profession.
Fantastic. And now you are in this profession of healing. And now when you look at all these moments that you have spent with Swami and the discourses that you have heard and the literature that you have read, and now you are in this profession where you are helping people directly, how do they both fall in place now?
That's a question that I think I could take a long time to answer. It is amazing because I see a lot of coincidences and interwoven things between Swami and this entire healing process. In fact, I've had experiences where I've worked with somebody and in my meditations I've had Swami directly helping that person, irrespective of whether the person is a Swami's devotee or not, or even has not heard of Swami, it doesn't matter. Those kind of things. Another thing is that when it comes to this concept of healing, it's not like I'm healing anybody. I'm only healing myself in my life. Everybody's healing themselves and I'm just part of it, I'm facilitating it, I'm just privileged to be an instrument in Swami's hands. And it is their own divine within them healing them. So that is what it's all about. I've had so many experiences, like my first two people with whom I worked using hypnotherapy immediately after my course. The first one I started, and at one point in time there was something to do with an energy release and I couldn't move further. And I had to stop the session, and you won't believe it, the next morning when I woke up, I had this vision of Swami healing that person, and it was almost like a dream, and Swami told me that you just sit and watch, and he did the process for that person in my dream, and I just kept sitting and watching. And once he had done it, he said, okay, so did you see it? I said, okay, yes, Swami, I saw it. He said, yes, it's done. And later I had this question that this person is not Swami's devotee, so should I just leave it at that or should I call this person? And then I decided I will not call the person. But later, sometime during the day, this person calls me and says, I don't know why, but I'm feeling very light and comfortable today. So I said, okay, fine, if you have time, let's meet again. We met, and when we tried to work on this, you know, this little pending issue that the person had, it had already been resolved in her mind. And then I knew that Swami had done something. This was the first. The second one was again a case where we had worked on some issue, a physical issue that this person had for over 15 years or 18 years. And at some point we had to stop because the person was physically tired. The session had gone for nearly 4 hours or more. So we had to stop. And I said that there's a small portion that's still pending. We will do it later whenever it's possible for you to, you know, find time. But I also told this person who was Swami's devotee that Swami is there for you, so just trust in him. A few days later, I get a SMS, you know, a text from this person that says, today morning I had a beautiful experience. It looked like I would have a seizure again. But even as that feeling started coming to me, suddenly I could feel that I'm seeing Swami, and I heard Swami's voice, and he asked me to do certain things. And basically what Swami had done was he completed whatever was left out on that day for this person. And after the person was completely healed. So it was like, you know, I did maybe 90% of the session through Swami, you know, Swami's grace. And the 10% that we couldn't finish on that day, Swami did in his, I don't know, dream or vision or whatever you call it. So Swami did it. He told him, you breathe like this, you say this, and all those things. So like that. So if I were to answer this question, it would just go into a big, big, long essay, because I've had after that so many experiences where I could see how Swami was directly helping each and every one of us in the healing process. It also made me realize that all of us are souls on a journey, and every incident, everything happening to our life, to us in our lives, is just either a lesson being learnt at the level of a soul, or it's an experience that we are undergoing. And it could simply become easy to go through that experience or to, you know, heal out of that experience by understanding why it's happening and by that complete surrender to God.
Fantastic. You started off saying that, you know, everything that we do in life as a student was to earn that one smile from Swami.
Yes.
And now you see that in a different plane in your life. Everything you do it as an offering to Swami and He's taking over.
Yes. On that, I just wanted to say, even the last time when you were saying, I wanted to kind of point out something. Sometime during my student days, I suddenly realized that the words, I'm offering this to you, seem to be like a little dicey thing for me. Because I realized that whatever was happening was Him working through us. So it seemed odd to say that, you know, I am offering it to you as if it is not His already. And even now with the healing and with every session that I am doing, I realize that, you know, it is actually Him who is doing it. And especially in this year 2012, it became a habit to start praying very explicitly, saying that, okay, Swami, I don't want my ego to interfere at all in this session. So you are healing that person. I am just privileged to be a witness. And after that, every session happens. There are times when I find myself saying things that in no way I would have physically planned to say. And I find myself doing sessions that I'm not even aware of. I find myself doing meditations that I've not learned anywhere and things like that. So the point is that sometimes I feel that we are not really offering anything to Him. What we are really doing is to just allow that little bit of ego in us to just subside, if only temporarily, so that the divine can just work. You know, and that's about it. There's no offering being made. There's no person offering. There's no God receiving the offering also. There is just an existential reality, and that's it. You're part of it.
You just remove any hindrance inside.
Yes.
For that connection to happen.
Yes.
Just let go completely.
Yes.
So that He takes over.
Yes.
Kind of.
Yes. And although it is true that God could do it no matter, you know, whether you say this or not, but somehow I also feel that somewhere Swami wants us to want it. Because I remember this discourse where Swami created a medallion with a lot of, you know, details about His students achieving a lot of things and doing a lot of things and in His mission. And when we heard this discourse, so Swami was saying that, you know, everything is written here. You know, there's a lot that's going to happen. It will be very magical. The only thing that I want from you boys is for you to tell me that I want to be a part of it. You don't worry about the how. You don't worry about the when. You don't worry about the what. You only tell me that I want to be a part of it. Now, why would Swami say that? You know, because as it is, all of us have dedicated our lives to Him, right? At some level or the other, at some point in time or the other, we did close our eyes and tell Him or look at Him and told Him physically that, Swami, I am offering my life to you. But still, why would He want us to do that? Because I feel that maybe at all times we are not able to keep ourselves at that state of awareness that we have offered it to Him. And therefore, every time, let's say for me, every time I start a session, for me to just close my eyes and say mentally that, yes, Swami, I am offering myself. Or let's say just before we start the music program, we offer ourselves to Swami, saying not the music, but ourselves to become the instruments. So maybe we need to do that often.
Absolutely. I think that is what Swami always probably indicated in every discourse. You know, He always said, you are Divyatma Sarupalara, you are Prema Sarupalaras. He always mentioned that. He said, you are all embodiments of love. He never said, no, my dear students or brothers and sisters or ladies and gentlemen, to anyone He was speaking to. He was always addressing each person as the Atma and as the love. And I think that is what He wants us to really always be consciously aware of. Fantastic. Thank you so much, brother. I know there is so much more that you can share. As you mentioned, if you talk about your work, you can go on for hours, because I think every day is an experience.
Yes.
And perhaps we would love to hear more from you. And I really invite you to come to the studio once again and share about these beautiful insights that Swami keeps giving you every now and then. And yes, we have to talk about the rhythmic energy. The wonderful endeavor that you and so many of your brothers have started to take the music of love to the people who are depressed, and we will definitely have a session on that. So do come again, and let's continue this discussion. Thank you so much for coming to the studios.
Thank you, brother. Sairam.
Sairam.
Sairam, dear listeners, you just heard Sai University alumnus, Brother S. Sriram, in conversation with Radio Sai's Bishop Prishti. We'd like to hear from you by email at listener@radiosai.org. It's now time for me to bid you a loving and a very hurried Sairam because I've gone over my time. Apologize for that. Till we meet next Thursday, please be well. Keep seeking and do whatever it takes to stay inspired. Sairam.